This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Just ahead, it's a local history piece. We talk about the Siege of Washington and the role colored troops played in that battle, and the unique architecture of pre-Civil War homes in Pamlico County. Alligators can turn up in unexpected places here in eastern North Carolina. Concrete plants, swimming pools, even hiding out under cars at a local dealership. One was found basking in the baking sun at Holden Beach near the North Carolina-South Carolina line. Encounters between humans and alligators are becoming more common, according to Extension wildlife biologist Jesse Burkhead.
You know, one thing we do see is that we certainly had an increase in development in coastal North Carolina. So as we have more people moving to the coast, you know, developments that have waterways, you know, man-made ponds, that sort of thing as part of their landscape, that increases opportunities for people to come into contact with alligators or to certainly see them out in the environment.
Now, the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission wants to document these encounters. Wildlife Diversity Program Coordinator Alan Boynton says a citizen science project called NC Alligators began this month, encouraging anyone who spots an alligator in the wild to upload and share photographs with them.
Well, when you take a picture with your phone, the phone records some metadata like the location, time, and so forth. And that's helpful to us to really get a better idea of where alligators occur in the state.
Photos uploaded to the website iNaturalist.com allow wildlife officials to track where sightings occur near human development. So far, the website has more than 110 observations from 65 people from as far south as Sunset Beach all the way to the North Carolina-Virginia border.
For us, it's a good way to collect in one place pictures of alligators, and we're able to verify that the picture is real and was taken then, and it lets us learn about where people are interacting with alligators and where alligators are, too.
The iNaturalist website has generated a lot of hits since the NC Alligator program started. One of the more recent posts came from Keith Kidwell of Chocowinity. He posted a picture of a 4.5 to 5 foot alligator he spotted during a fishing trip on the Neuse River.
So we were down probably a half a mile down creek from Swift Creek, and we went into a side cove there. It looked like it was going to be some good fishing. And got up in there. My wife was taking a break from fishing, sitting on the back of the boat, dangling her feet in the water. Looked up and said, "Is that an alligator over there?" And I looked and I said, "Yep, sure is." And needless to say, she came up out of the water pretty quick. So,
catching a glimpse of an alligator in the wild can be a thrilling experience. But alligators in eastern North Carolina are actually shy and reclusive, rarely posing a threat to humans. This was forefront in my mind when I met John Jacobson, an avid kayaker and photographer from New Bern, on Wednesday morning. He agreed to take me to a spot he's seen alligators along Bachelor's Creek, upstream from the Neuse River.
There are two spots. One spot, I've seen both the male and the female there, the female during the summer and the male during the spring. And then there's another spot further up, which is where the female has her nest, and she will stay in that spot.
After loading our gear into a pair of kayaks, John and I set off from Glen Burnie Park to the first spot, about 4 miles away. The wind was at our face and the current was flowing against us. As we slowly made our way upstream, the waterway became narrower and wilder. Osprey fly overhead, mullet leap from the water all around us, and turtles splash into the water as we pass by. After about an hour and a half of paddling, John motions for me to come alongside his kayak.
Stay close to me. But I want you to stay on the outside so you get the first glimpse.
Okay.
We should see as we're going coming around that bend.
Around this bend up here?
Yeah, it's an open area, a little cove, and should be straight on from the sighting as we come around that bend.
We stealthily make our way around the bend, surrounded by moss-covered cypress trees hanging over the water. Sunlight filters through the canopy and reflects off the water. A partially submerged log where John says he's seen the alligator sunning itself before is unoccupied. Undeterred, we paddle a half mile upstream when John motions for me to slow down.
So we have an alligator, and she's about 25 feet away from me. I gotta tell you, my heart is racing right now. John is in his kayak about 30 feet to my left, and the alligator just swam right across the front of the bank and is now resting in a patch of lily pads. She's not moving. She just doesn't seem to be bothered by us at all.
After a minute, she slowly swims away and sinks into the marsh.
I think she's between 12 and 13 feet.
People several years ago talked about that she's, who had been on this island, have talked to her about her being 12 feet, and I think she's a little bigger than she was when I took pictures of her 7 years ago.
That's big for an eastern North Carolina alligator. Since this region is the northernmost extent of their range, Wildlife Diversity Program Coordinator Alan Boynton says the cooler climate affects their rate of reproduction, barely keeping pace with their mortality. It also affects how large alligators grow.
We do not have as long a growing season. It gets warmer later in the spring, and it becomes colder earlier in the fall, the further north you go. So alligators depend on food to grow, and they don't have as much time each year to grow, so they grow more slowly.
Alligators have a natural range of about 25 coastal counties. They're commonly found in swamps, lakes, marshes, and ponds, something eastern North Carolina has a lot of. Farther up the coast, they're few and far between.
Our alligators are not like alligators further south. They're not continuously distributed, so they exist in separate populations. For example, we have a separate population up in Hyde County that's separated by some distance from other alligators.
That's where the NC Alligator Project comes in. Right now, it's mating season, so males are moving about looking for a mate. Folks who see an alligator or a nest are encouraged to snap a picture with their phone and upload it to iNaturalist.com. Extension wildlife biologist Jesse Burkhead says, just make sure you give the alligator some space.
Anytime folks are observing alligators or any kind of wild animal in the wild, you always want to maintain a safe, respectful distance from the animal. And the great thing is that most of us with our smartphones can capture a photo of an alligator from, a good safe distance away from the animal. These don't have to be, the greatest photo you've ever taken, but just a picture where you can see the animal in the photo is going to be enough to provide, that observation data that we're looking for.
Burkhead warns the public not to feed the alligators to get a better picture. Not only is it illegal, it's dangerous for both the observer and for the animal. For more information on the NC Alligator Project and to see pictures of the alligator encounter on my kayak trip this week, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. This is the Down East Journal. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. People who love history can't get enough of Civil War stories. Today, Chris Thomas has more on the 1863 Siege of Washington and the historic role African Americans played in it.
By the time the war reached its second anniversary, much of northeastern North Carolina had been reclaimed by American troops from the newly minted Confederacy. It was part of Union General Ambrose Burnside's expedition, meant to block Confederate attempts to use the waters within the Outer Banks, including the Tar and Pamlico Rivers, and it was one of the earliest successes for the Union cause. This was due, in part, to support for the Union in the region. Dr. Gerald Propakovich, history professor at East Carolina University, explains.
In fact, there were as many, if not more, Union sympathizers in the eastern part of the state, certainly early in the war, than there were Confederates. There were Union regiments raised in eastern North Carolina.
But on March 30th, 1863, rebel soldiers attempted to break the blockade and test the will of Federal troops, now under the command of General John Foster, by putting one of its garrisons under siege, Washington, which had a population of just under 1,600 in 1860. For 3 weeks, nothing went in or out of the heavily fortified town, apart from exchanged rounds of artillery. Lisa Jones, a local historian and Washington, North Carolina native, describes what we'd have seen if we were there that spring.
They would see a city in chaos. They'd see a city that had been decimated by war.
She's one of the co-founders of the historic Washington Underground Railroad Museum, which started as a way to teach people about African-American history in Washington.
They would have seen, at that point, probably more slaves in Washington than they would have seen of any other population. They would have seen again, slaves working on the waterfront, either to help repair ships or caulk ships, making them watertight. Probably would have seen them working among some of the buildings that had been, again, decimated, trying to find shelter.
As Burnside and his troops snaked their way along the Tar and Pamlico Rivers, lawmakers in the Big Washington were mulling over what to do with slaves who found refuge behind Union lines. Prokopovich said that while there were some who remained loyal to the Confederacy, most threw their hats in with the Union.
They saw nothing to be gained from supporting the Confederacy and recognized, even before it was official Union policy, that somehow the Union war effort was going to cause a lot of problems for the institution of slavery. So many slaves escaped, made their way to Union lines, sought to work for the Union Army or volunteer and serve in the Union ranks, and some of them were able to do so.
Most were put right back to work by Union troops with labor, resembling that back on the plantation and docks. But some took up arms. In towns, including Elizabeth City, former slaves were already receiving arms to protect federal gains, and when rebel troops tried to test the will of the Beaufort County garrison, about 120 men were given guns to help hold the fort. Jones said it was the first time they'd been paid for their services.
They were not only given a small stipend to fight, but they were given food and clothing.
Arming the former slaves was not a matter of altruism or idealism. It was a matter of strategy. These former slaves helped guide Northern troops, most of whom were from New England detachments, through the woods and swamps of North Carolina's coastal plain.
Many of the contraband slaves were expert guides on the water. They were expert guides in going into areas that may not have been that well known by the Union Army first coming in. And so they could specifically navigate rivers and parts of, you know, overland.
Because they were seen as property before and after their escape, Jones says little was known about the men and their lives before, during, and after the siege.
They would have been contraband soldiers, so they would have been, at one point, been slaves. We tried to find out if any free men were among them, but usually the term contraband refers to that they had been slaves.
Multiple members of the 120 were killed during the 3-week-long siege of Washington. One in particular, known as Big Bob, a contraband slave, helped spark the interest of Jones and other local historians to find out more. In the siege's early hours, on the night of March 31st, the 1st North Carolina Volunteers, a white Unionist outfit, led in part by Captain Charles Lyons, had to withdraw their post at Robbins Point near the town.
Well, the little skiff that Captain Lyons was on got stuck on a sandbar. Big Bob was also on that little skiff with him, along with about 3 other Union soldiers. And at one point, Bob realized they were all in peril of dying. And he is supposed to have stood up, pushed the boat off of the sandbar, and they were able to successfully get to the shore.
Big Bob, who had escaped from his owners and arrived in Washington soon before the siege, was mortally wounded in the gunfire. As is the case with many stories of the war, Big Bob's is primarily an oral tradition, though poems and prose honoring him were later published after Bob's surgeon relayed the story to a colleague.
Union soldiers talked about him in their journals, and Dr. Robert Ware, he told another surgeon, Dr. Fisher. Dr. Fisher relayed the incident to newspapers throughout the country, and so that's why we know about Big Bob.
By mid-April 1863, Union soldiers didn't show signs of wearing down, and since an invasion of Little Washington was never part of the Confederates' plan, they withdrew. Union troops remained there until the following year, before heading to New Bern and eventually home to Massachusetts. Jones said former slaves followed the unit and put down roots north of the Mason-Dixon line, seeing some action along the way.
We do know that 2 soldiers from Washington did fight in the Battle of New Market, Virginia. And so we know that they at some point did see further fighting with the Union Army. We just don't have the documented evidence.
Jones said that though she was born and raised in Washington, these stories weren't imparted to her in her history classes. She believes the reasoning for that can be explained with an old proverb.
Until the lion can talk, You will always hear the hunter's version of what happened.
Apart from a handful of cases, Dr. Jill Propakovich says it's been a slow process getting those stories from academia to the general public.
You have a lot of very dramatic stories about this. A lot of it is only now really being talked about, really being publicized for the public. Historians know about this. You can go to the library and read about any of these stories. But the key is not what do historians read about in libraries. It's what do kids learn about in fifth grade, what do people see in movies, what do we see in museums and battlefields where the public goes to get its history.
A marker now stands in honor of the 120 on West Main Street in the original Washington, next to another marker commemorating the siege itself. It was dedicated earlier this month at a public ceremony near the town's waterfront. I'm Chris Thomas.
This is the Down East Journal. On Sunday, local author and historian Stan Allen will give an afternoon presentation on the architecture of pre-Civil War houses in Pamlico County. Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with Allen about his decades of research and his passion to preserve the memories of Pamlico County's historic homes.
Well, I actually grew up with these homes. I never lived in any of them, but they were always around, and my family was historically minded, and I heard a lot of lore and stories about them, and I saw them from a very early age. And then I really got interested in the architecture of them when I was about 15, which would be 1957, 56. From that point on, I started actually literally studying them. So,
in your presentation, you've got an ambitious lecture, so to speak.
Yes.
300 years of Pamlico County architecture from 1550 to right before the Civil War in 1860.
Yeah.
What is significant about this period of architectural history?
Well, I'm going to have to talk real fast, obviously, but no, that's a joke because there's just not that much of it left, honestly. But I wanted to extend back into the Native American era, so I'm going to be using some of the paintings from the John White voyages that preceded what we know as the Lost Colony, because the people that were painted around Roanoke Island are the very people that lived in ancient Pamlico County. And then we'll go on into the pre-Civil War European architecture. The main thing is that there's a group of houses that were built in the early 1800s that are actually unique to Pamlico County. I've been looking for a long time. I've never found others like them. So it's a school that's honestly rapidly disappearing. But
speaking about that school of architecture, what made the homes in Pamlico County and Oriental stand out from other homes in eastern North Carolina during that particular time period, or were there similarities?
There's lots of similarities, of course, because there was what you call a vocabulary of building back in those days. But in Pamlico, the main difference was the roof. Most of the pre-Civil War houses that you see, and we're talking about wooden houses, have porches on the front. If they have a double-story porch, a two-story porch, the roof kind of kicks out over it. But in these houses, it's inset into the roof. The roof is just a straight gable. There's no slant or kick to cover the attached porch. And that becomes a room, an outdoor room for the houses.
And really, they always said that the higher the ceiling, I guess the higher the roof.
Exactly.
The cooler it got during the summertime.
Yes, these houses are really engineering marvels when it comes to living in an unair-conditioned, which of course they didn't have, house. And in that they're designed to create ventilation. And it really works, I can tell you from my personal experience.
Well, you can tell me about even staying in one of these houses? Or
yes, I spent a lot of time in them. The ones I could get in, which was most of them were standing empty when I was a teenager back in the 50s. And I spent a lot of time in them and was able to observe, without even expecting it, how this all works, this ventilation system. It's very efficient. The ceilings are high. The staircase in the middle serves as a chute to send the air upstairs. And you can stand in front of the front door if the windows were open properly all the way up to the top, and the breeze will be pulling in strongly.
Are there still pre-Civil War homes standing in Pamlico County? And can you mention a few where our listeners might be familiar with the areas in which they're located?
Yes, Mac. Well, compared to Craven County, which, as I believe that Peter Sandbeck in his book said, there were 123 pre-Civil War houses, or maybe 150 or so, but plenty of them. But in Pamlico County, we have the big number of four. There's only four left.
Only four left?
Yes. I have pictures of some of the ones that we've lost. I have pictures of the ones that are there, of course. And then there's some that I'm going to conjecture, if that's a verb, about what they might have looked like.
Were a lot of these homes lost just to disrepair and fire or storms, that sort of thing?
All of that, yes, and erosion and vandalism, I'm sorry to say, and just basically neglect.
Now, I understand you have a collection of photographs of the home that you're going to be sharing at the presentation.
I took pictures of all the houses with one of those Brownie expandable cameras that looked kind of like an old steam locomotive. And that was the start. Unfortunately, I didn't use that camera for all of my early pictures. Some of them were little pocket cameras that didn't turn out well at all, but they're documented.
In addition to the homes, what are some of the artifacts that you found?
Most of the artifacts that I have actually came from one house that my father grew up down the lane from, and our family was very close with that family, the Delamars. I've found a couple of other things, though, that I'll show. One is just an architectural fragment. Another is a clock that I rescued out of a pile of trash. And then there's one artifact, very special artifact, that will have a very interesting story. I almost hate to even say what it is, but I'll go ahead. It's a sword. Yes, and it really has some history to it.
And you'll be at the Oriental History Museum. That's on Broad Street at Oriental.
Yes.
And it's April 30th, 2 until 3 p.m., and it's a free event, correct?
Right. I'll have photographs and artifacts and stories.
All right. Well, Stan, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Thank you so much, Matt.
If you need more information about this presentation on pre-Civil War houses, you can always check out the events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. So I have to admit that there are some phrases that come up in gardening conversations that set my teeth on edge. Companion planting is one of them. You may have heard that carrots love tomatoes, or roses love garlic, or that certain plants will mysteriously grow better if planted in the right combination. Unfortunately, most of these supposed partnerships do not hold up to scientific scrutiny. Many companion planting resources state that growing basil mixed with tomatoes will improve the growth of the tomatoes, while certain crops, like Brussels sprouts, are antagonists to tomatoes. Instead, it's suggested that Brussels sprouts should be planted with aromatic herbs. There isn't a lot of scientific work that's been done digging into this topic, but while I was in school at West Virginia University, a doctoral student, Michael Bomford, designed an experiment to look at this theory. He set up a study comparing the growth of tomatoes, basil, and Brussels sprouts, whether they were grown alone in single stands, in the recommended mixture of tomatoes and basil, and in the discouraged mixture of tomatoes and Brussels sprouts together. What the now Dr. Bomford found was that the popularly recommended mixtures did not yield better or make more efficient use of the land than the popularly discouraged mixture did. His study did find that mixtures of crops could be more productive than a single stand of a crop. This makes sense. When you plant plants of the same type next to each other, such as tomatoes in a row, each tomato plant competes with the plant on either side of it. By mixing the tomatoes with a lower growing crop like basil, you are effectively increasing the space between your tomato plants and creating less competition. This means more yield per plant for your tomatoes. However, you could have achieved this increased yield per plant simply by spacing the tomatoes further apart. The basil was not an integral piece of the puzzle. There certainly are some plants that like to grow together because they benefit from similar growing conditions. Wild azaleas can often be found growing in the company of witch hazel and summer sweet. In the garden, hellebores, hostas, and ferns thrive in those locations as well. So these plants make great partners, not because of any supposed synergistic characteristics, but because they like the same growing conditions. Herbs have similarities in their growing requirements as well. The woody Mediterranean herbs like rosemary, oregano, and thyme benefit from well-drained, low-fertility soil, and they grow well together, even in the same pot. More succulent herbs like basil, parsley, cilantro, and dill benefit from slightly moister, richer conditions. There are a lot of solid reasons to look at your plant spacing, diversify your garden, and keep yourself up to date on the new information coming out about the fascinating world of plants. Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. Have a great weekend.